Good evening. We're into the speech precepts of the Bodhisattva. I think these next 6th and 7th precept, personally, I find like the most challenging and hardest of them all. They're all very challenging, but this is like, I don't know, maybe we each have our struggles, but not speaking of others' faults. Whew. So the Brahmajala Sutra, our source for the precepts, says, a disciple of Buddha does not speak of the faults of bodhisattva home leavers or bodhisattva householders or of monks and nuns, nor encourage others to do so. Encourages others to do so. One must not create the causes, conditions, methods, or karma of discussing the faults of the assembly. A bodhisattva, whenever hearing of harmful people, those outside the way, or followers of the two vehicles, Shravakas and Pratyeka Buddhas, speak of practices contrary to the Dharma or contrary to the precepts within the Buddha's Sangha, ought to instruct them with a compassionate mind and lead them to develop wholesome faith in the Mahayana. If instead one discusses the faults and misdeeds of the assembly, one commits a parajika offense. Defeat. Whew. So, a couple of points that stand out here are, one is, it's discussing the faults of these particular others, that basically those in the Buddha's Sangha, is what this precept says. So in Dogen's Shobogenzo Jukai, in the Shobogenzo, most of these precepts have been identical wording to the Brahmajala Sutra. And in this one, he says, it's the longest of all the precepts in Chinese for Dogen. It literally says, not speaking of zaike, shuke, bosatsu faults. So we have these terms, staying home and leaving home. So it's not speaking of the staying home and the leaving home bodhisattva's faults. So those who, and I think we could say this means those who received the bodhisattva precepts, actually, whether as lay people or priests. And then later, the only other essay we really have of Dogen on the bodhisattva precepts is the Kyoju Kaimon, the essay on teaching and conferring the precepts. And in that one, actually, Dogen just says, not speaking of faults, period. He doesn't put this whole long thing about these two different types of bodhisattvas. And I think that's maybe where our version comes from, or maybe we just don't want to say such a long thing. We just say, often, not speaking of the faults of others. So Dogen includes all others, I think, in the Kyoji Kaimon. Sometimes we say not slandering, but I think that's not exactly the meaning of this precept in any of the versions, because slander, as it says in the dictionary, is speaking false charges or false statements or misrepresentations which damage another's reputation. So the meaning of slander is, as I understand it, always false. You can't slander somebody about something they actually did. It's always an exaggerated or a false accusation. Does that ring true to people? So, which would be, definitely, we don't want to do that as bodhisattvas, but to just say not falsely accusing people of things is much easier, I think, to practice than not speaking of faults, period. True faults.
There's plenty of material.
Yeah. There's plenty of material for true faults, right?
But it seems like the core is not having a negative impact on one's reputation, whether it's true.
That's true. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Whether it's true or false. But speaking of true faults is much more difficult to do, or our version of true faults, because what is a true fault anyway? So we'll unpack this in many ways as this goes on here. But did you have a
point? Since you're bringing it up, the right speech includes no slander.
Oh.
So maybe sometimes people conflate this precept with right speech.
Yeah.
As I'm studying that, there's like four different kinds of...
Yeah, the four kinds.
Yeah, and one of them relates to slander.
Uh-huh.
So I could see how maybe sometimes people think it's interchangeable, but I think the distinction is interesting.
Yeah, that would be interesting to see in the Pali suttas where those four types of right and wrong speech are taught, what exactly is the original there too. I think there's some commentary, and I didn't bring the sutra tonight, from the Pali, where it says, the speech that divides one group against another. So I think that's sometimes the commentary on that one, which wouldn't also necessarily be slander. That could be, actually speaking of this person's faults to this one's, just to get them against each other. Yeah. Yeah, so, first of all, I think this interesting point that it's particularly in the original precept, not speaking of faults of those within the Buddha's Sangha, and kind of implying that it's okay to speak of faults of others outside that. And, so just one commentary on this Brahmajala Sutra from ancient times quotes another related sutra, the Jewel Necklace Sutra. Sometimes these are seen as a pair of Bodhisattva precept sutras. And that sutra says, receiving the precepts and breaking them is better than not receiving them and not breaking them. Receiving, and this is the Bodhisattva precepts, and breaking them is better than not receiving them, but not going against them. And Dogen also says, I think he's probably getting it from this sutra. He in his Shuke Kudoku, the merit and virtue of leaving home, which he's kind of equating with receiving precepts. He says, better to leave home and receive the precepts than to not and still practice good conduct. And I always thought, that was such a strange and radical statement. And I think I would interpret it as the intention to actually sincerely receive the Bodhisattva precepts is this such a noble intention. It's kind of like, I really want to vow to live for the benefit of all beings and practice wholesome conduct and not harm others. And I want to publicly make that vow, and that's a huge thing to actually, whether we feel like we can do it or not, to say, I want to do this, is like, I think the sutra is saying, that's such a great thing that even then if you mess up and forget and still your intention is so great compared to, I may or may not follow these, I'll try right now, but I'm not going to make some big vow about it because I might change my mind later, for example. Or at least my options open. Some people might think this way. But they're actually are following the precepts, but they just don't have the vow to follow them. And these sutras are saying, it's better to make the vow and then fall. We could argue this, of course. I think it's very easy to argue the other side of this. In fact, that's why it's such a radical statement that stops me when I hear it. But again, maybe just taking it as a pointer to the kind of awesome virtue in making great vows, even if we can't, even if they're beyond us, to aim in this direction. So The also a commentary on that from an ancient commentary says, speaking of the faults of the Buddha's Sangha damages the faith of many people in the Buddha Dharma. And because of this, they will develop aversion to the Buddha Dharma, which will impede their path to awakening. So I think there's some truth to that. Again, I think there's a shadow side to this, because we can say, we think the Buddha Dharma is great, and so we want to protect it. And maybe there are, we see this, I think, in the Catholic Church, right? There was this, apparently, decades of child abuse kind of going on with the clergy, but the church wanted to protect its own reputation for good reasons. But then then there's this denial going on in order to protect itself. And I think the American Buddhist Sangha is pretty good about not hiding stuff too much. We like to actually like bring out the scandals and expose them in modern times, and which may have its benefits, and I think for this reason of this commentary may also have its drawbacks. If people just hear about the scandals, they think, well, Buddhism's kind of messed up. There's so many scandals. In fact, there may be more in Zen than Theravada. I think probably Tibetan and Zen, I think, do have more teacher scandals than the Theravada teachers. So they might say, well, Theravada is more like more virtuous.
You have to be careful too when the Catholic tradition and the Zen tradition are traditionally, and is changing in Zen, patriarchies.
Mm-hmm.
And the victims of these scandals in Zen are usually women.
Yeah.
You know, this like 100-year-old teacher groping all of his students, Baker Roshi, and it's like, all of these are like protecting the, like if they were concealed, like protecting the patriarchy.
Ah, yeah, good point, yes.
Yes.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. Yeah. The Sangha, but particularly, yeah. And I think that's why in modern times this is getting kind of reversed, because in American Buddhism there isn't really the same kind of patriarchy. It's kind of evened out. There's probably equal number of male and female teachers.
Yeah, it's getting better.
Yeah. So it may be that that's part of in the Brahmajala Sutra, of this kind of like, maybe if we start getting really nitpicky about little faults of the Sangha, just because we're really into that and kind of exposing that across the whole community, then people maybe do start losing faith in it. Even though maybe the meaning was to increase faith in it because of our honesty in exposing the weaknesses, it maybe has this other effect. And in the commentaries to Dogen says in his Shobogenza Zui Monki, around this point of criticizing the Buddha's Sangha in particular, he says, no matter how bad they may be, when more than four monks gather together, they form a Sangha, which is a priceless treasure of the nation. This should be most highly respected and honored. So I'm saying there's something just so great about people trying. Again, I hear it as this making an effort and trying to practice the way. So even if they're really bad, this is a great thing, that this is still, the Buddha's way is still being carried on in some form like this, because it has this potential for this great freedom and benefit and compassion.
So five is the quorum?
I think I have heard, well, this is what he's saying here. I think I might have heard four.
Yes.
In the past. But that is an ancient teaching from the Buddha's time, yeah. Have you heard that?
Well, I mean, it obviously says four, it says more than four.
Yeah.
So that means five or more is the quorum?
Is an official Sangha. I would say four or five. I can't, it might be a translation issue or something.
Yeah. There's two little.
So. There's two little.
Two is four, two little.
Because Sangha means like community, right? And why did the Buddha teach this number thing? Because it is in the Vinaya text. I think partly around ceremonial procedures. Like you need this, like a quorum, like a legal quorum.
I don't know, we did it with three tonight.
I think for an official full moon ceremony, the precepts renewal ceremony from the Vinaya, you need four to make it official. So
Jesus said that a church is defined by three people.
Oh.
When three are gathered in my name.
Oh, interesting.
It's a church. And isn't there the concept of a minion?
Ten in Judaism.
Really?
Ten.
Less just 10 witnesses, right? Or is
ten people in order to like do certain rituals.
10 overall.
To say certain prayers. To say like the prayer for somebody who's mourning.
Yeah, that's
if
nice.
You have the rabbi and then nine that's
acceptable.
Okay.
Yeah.
Same with
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Oh, they have to be bar mitzvah, but traditionally they have to be men, although that's sort of.
That's a similar thing to the Vinaya, the monastic regulations to ordain fully ordain a monk or nun, a bhikshu or bhikshuni, you need 10. Fully ordained bhikshus. And then I think it's like for the, there's, that's why there's this kind of like difficulties in the bhikshuni nuns sangha in those orders, because I think you need 10 bhikshus and 10 bhikshunis for the nuns ordination.
And that's like
nuns
don't exist.
Yeah, some will claim that.
That means no new ones.
Yeah. So there's all that stuff. But we don't need to speak of others' faults.
We could, because we, ours works pretty well.
Ours works, yeah.
We'd be content with it.
And I think this is...
just the other...
Yeah. People. And you know, this is related to this Brahmajala Sutra, as I understand historically, when Saicho, if you remember the story from the first class, Saicho in the 8th century in Japan, said, let's make a completely bodhisattva priest ordination without these Vinaya precepts, partly because of these types of all these rules that you can't ever change. But the Bodhisattva precepts are like their own thing. You don't need this quorum of 10 men and 10 women to do a ceremony. So, and he wanted to establish his own Tendai school and not have to go down to the capital to these government sponsored ordinations. So he said, let's do our own thing, and we don't need to import these like government monks to come do our thing. So I think it is related to our easy way of doing bodhisattva ordinations. Have a lot less strictures, and they can happen anytime. Even it says in the Brahmajala Sutra, in the minor precepts, it says. And also the Jewel Necklace Sutra, it's kind of a sister sutra. They both say that the best is to receive these precepts from someone who's received them, and you should, you know, if there's someone within several hundred miles who's received them, you should receive them in person like that. But if you're in some really distant land where there isn't anyone for hundreds of miles and you can't go there, then you can actually, before an image of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, receive these precepts from the pictures or statues of Buddhas. So, and I think occasionally people have tried doing this in history. But luckily now, everywhere in the world, there's no more than a 100-mile radius without a bodhisattva. Maybe in the deep in the Amazon jungles, there may be 200 mile. The ocean, yeah, that's right. If you're out at sea, in a boat with no bodhisattvas.
Then the ship captain can give you the precepts.
If he's got them. So again, Dogen says this sangha of bad monks is a priceless treasure of the nation. And then he goes on to say, as a senior practitioner or teacher, you have to instruct and guide them with a compassionate, grandmotherly mind. When you see someone's faults and wish to compassionately guide them, you must find skillful means to avoid arousing their anger and do so as if you were talking about something else. Mm-hmm. I think he's just saying, so it's okay to speak to others about their faults, but be very careful. Don't just be so direct, kind of say, you might say something like, like, I'm just thinking of, this wasn't a big fault, but I was thinking of this conversation with Rachel where she gets our tofu. You know, she orders the bulk tofu, and I think she might have forgotten it in a couple weeks. And I said kind of jokingly, like, I think I'll go have some tofu now. I could really go for some scrambled tofu.
And
I'm crying. Yeah, I think she got it, and it was, oh yeah. As if I was speaking about something else.
I was like, wasn't it Patrick? No, I think I got it.
It might not have been you.
I thought he was a very good astute psychology, because
Otherwise
you confront defenses.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, very astute psychology and skillful means. Mm-hmm. Pretending that you're talking about something else.
You're really talking about scrambled tofu.
Yeah.
Sometimes people do it this way.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes Jiko's give you the sense so that it actually lands where your hand is.
Yeah.
Some Jikos do that.
Yeah, or even
it's
like...
It's very pleasant.
When I learned Jiko, I learned it this way. Yeah.
Some people arrive on time.
I really like when they do. Yes. So, in another commentary on this precept, it quotes the Parinirvana Sutra, where the Buddha says, if you cannot find any goodness in sentient beings that is praiseworthy, try to recall their Buddha nature and praise that. Yeah. That's a good one, yeah? Because everybody shares this completely free, compassionate, Buddha nature, this total potential to be of great benefit, even though it's obscured by what we might call faults. I think it's a great way when we're thinking of speaking of others' faults, just try to remember. And the more we can remember our own Buddha nature and clarify what that is, not as some abstract idea or just something that we have faith in, but we come to know it more and more, then we really can see it in others and know it is so by its very definition, by its very being. And a commentary on that said, there's no sentient being in samsara without faults. And one who speaks of others' faults also has those faults. So, is it the Bible that... No, I think it's just some story that says, if you live in a glass house, don't throw stones. Maybe that's a little different. Maybe the Bible one is...
Let he without sin cast the first
stone. Yes, yes. Yeah, that's a good one. Mm-hmm. And also in the Bible is you look at the splinter in another's eye instead of removing the log from your own eye. Does anyone know that something like that? Yeah, we see this small fault, splinter-like fault in somebody else, but there's this log-like fault over on this side that we don't notice. Something like that.
Yeah. But are we still speaking as if this is only about people in the Sangha?
Well, now I think we can... that's to kind of unpack the traditional thing about the Sangha, and maybe which is emphasizing how amazing it is that people will take up the Bodhisattva vow. Now, I think that Dogen then expands that himself to say, not speaking of faults, period. In that version, he doesn't even say others, literally, not speaking of faults. And I think I found a Koban translation that says, not dwelling on past mistakes, period. Not of self or others. And I thought that was...
For this precept?
Yeah, for this precept, not dwelling on past mistakes. And I think that is what we would call faults of others, but even our own in that way. And Dogen's Kyoju Kaimon version doesn't even say others, although that's usually what's implied. But we might say not even, you know, really, you know, getting overly involved in our own faults, too. And...
But you would
want
to learn from your faults.
You would want to Yeah, exactly. So we have confession, practice, and so on, and acknowledging avowal of our own karmic, ancient twisted karma faults. But overly, you know, getting like bogged down in guilt or something. In being upright attention, where she says, speaking of others as opposed to with others, or face to face with them, but speaking about the third party, which is what this, he's defining this precept, speaking of some other who's not the one that you're speaking to, with the intention, conscious or unconscious, to cause disrespect or disharmony between people, is the meaning of this precept. So, we can, get into all kinds of ways that it may be possible and very beneficial to speak of faults of others, actually, but not to cause disrespect or disharmony between people. I think that's a nice way to cover the bases if we're speaking out against politicians, for example, because they're actually because there might be some faults to speak of. We're not doing it for the purpose of causing disrespect or disharmony between people. And Tenzin Roshi says, if someone is criticizing another, we can ask that they speak with that other person directly. And he says he tries to do that in Dokusan, which is, I think, hard to... I'm not so good at that. Listen to it, and he says, I try to immediately, if somebody starts speaking of someone else's faults, I say, wait, before you even tell me, have you spoken to them about it? Because I don't even really want to hear about it. And so he's done that with me, I think, really turn it back like that. Now, it may be that there's a lot of gray area, as there are in all these precepts, of where we're speaking about our own issue, and we can't even speak about our own issue without bringing in this issue of another somehow. I think these things happen.
So, Kogyo, it sounds like that supports the emphasis on the Sangha because it's about maintaining harmony.
Yeah, and I think also it's helping the student, in this case, not speak of others' faults, which often doesn't help that much because the teacher can maybe just listen and be like, okay, well... why don't you try to accept it or something, or why don't you try to work with it like this? Instead, why don't you go right to the source of it, which often we don't want to do. We'd rather speak to somebody else. It's easier to speak to somebody else about the fault. It's a nice practice to encourage people. And if we feel like, well, I don't really need to go to them, well, then maybe I don't need to bring it up, right? And maybe, no, it is a really big thing. Well, then maybe I should go to them and speak of it in this kind way, as Dogen says, in this way, not to arouse their anger and not to cause disrespect or disharmony, but to point something out. Roshi says, can we criticize a teacher, a teaching, or a person without looking down on him, her, or it, in the spirit of utmost respect for all beings? So Maybe so, but I think this is very hard to do, right? Criticize without looking down on someone, but to bring out some beneficial something. And Dogen himself, right, who has an essay on these precepts, I think many people have noticed who have studied Dogen that he can really rant. And he can really speak of others' faults very directly in his writings, calling them like names. And people like to skip over those parts and wonder, why is Dogen, you know, in his great compassion, speaking that way? And when I think about places he does that, I think it's almost always speaking of people who aren't alive. Now, that might not be such an important distinction, but it might be, because it maybe feels like they're gone, and now they are just represented by this teaching or this practice that they did, and I want to point that out. So it's not actually harming the person because they're gone. Let's say it harms their posthumous reputation.
Poor Seneca.
Yeah, right. And it's many Zen teachers too, and Chinese ancestors, Dogen, will praise some and criticize others. Usually, you know, not just randomly ever, right, but always about some particular teaching that they give that CC feels like is off the mark. And so I feel when Dogen's writing that he's got this incredible passion for true Dharma and making sure that it stays pure and true to the Buddha's and ancestors' understanding. So if he feels like it's a little off, and especially if people are kind of going along with the version that's off, he'll raise it up and point it out in his love of Dharma, in his love for truth and Dharma. But it's a tricky edge, yes.
What I try to do if I really am feeling like criticizing something that someone's done is to have the emphasis on the thing, not the person, and the reason. Like, I don't think it was so good when you did this thing, not because of you, not because of the person, but because this thing might make these people feel this way or whatever.
Yes.
So that feels at least a better way to do it. So you're not really criticizing the person themselves, but
mm-hmm. Totally.
An action that you think might be being harmful in some way, which sounds like when Dogen does that and other Zen masters do that, and they can be quite scathing.
Yeah.
But you can tell it's always because they want the Dharma to be pure and true.
Yeah.
And not get, you know, go off into some cul-de-sac somewhere that's not going to be fruitful for people.
Yeah. And I think when he says they're like, you know, stray dogs and bald-headed idiots and stuff like that. Maybe that's a little unnecessary. You can just say, bring out the point. But,
I thought too. And also, sometimes I think it's better to make a criticism very clearly without any negative real emotion, because sometimes being oblique and going around the side actually just feels sort of passive-aggressive to some people. And sometimes I prefer someone just to say to me, when you come in, could you try shutting the door more quietly or something, because when you do it loud it disturbs people, rather than, you know, sometimes someone saying, oh, you should shut the door quietly.
Yeah.
Sometimes it feels like, why don't you just tell me what?
Yes, so good point.
It's a fine line.
Yeah, depends on the person.
Not being offensive, but then not being scared to simply say something, that's because you're not criticizing the human being. You're not saying you are a bad person because you shut the door too hard or something.
Yes.
You handed the instincts.
Mm-hmm.
You just, you know.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Like you said, it's all pretty
great.
It's
yeah. And around. Yeah, intention. And things like ceremonial forms, we can easily feel like we're. It's a fault. If we ring the bell wrong or something, we can feel so bad, like we did some fault. And I think that's a part of the nice thing about Zen practice is we can feel that, but then if we kind of step back a little bit and look, it's just ringing a bell, right? It's not that big a thing. But it's nice because it's a kind of a safe situation to have those feelings come up without some big, moral sort of fault finding. I think when we get into ethics and morality, which is different than where you ring the bell, then it's, the stakes are higher, and we can feel like, even if we're critiquing an action instead of a person, it hits much more deeply, right?
Well, both Aitken Roshi and Tenshin Roshi, when writing about this precept, make a distinction between criticizing people and gossiping and directly and with love offering feedback for growth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that that's the heart of healthy communities and Zen. I mean, so much of my training was being corrected. I don't know about the rest of me, but I treasure that aspect of Zen.
Yeah.
And other communities I'm in where, you're learning something and somebody, basically, is just really direct with you and not doing it angrily or telling you that you're scum or something with love. But, are you aware
that, I think the key thing is with love. And sometimes it might not, in Zen communities, sometimes I think it doesn't come from love. It comes from, of course it's the Buddha nature is all pervading love, but we forget that and we come from, a person really annoys me and I gotta point this thing out. Mm-hmm. And so I think the more we can remember that we're coming from love.
Well, and maybe that's where the ethical precept part comes in. Is studying our own, intention.
Yeah.
And where we're coming from.
Yes.
Am I doing this for my own aggrandizement?
That's right.
Or am I actually doing this because I care about this person? And I want to support them.
Yeah.
And it might be beneficial.
Yep.
To share this.
Really looking at intentions. Yeah. Aitken Roshi, in The Mind of Clover, I thought this was a nice point. He says is, sometimes it may be necessary and appropriate for me to say to someone in confidence, I'm not sure you can get the best kind of training at such and such a place or with such and such a teacher. But if you ask me in an open meeting what I think of Doodad Roshi, I'm likely to make a vague response. Is your purpose to establish a concept of a person's character or is it to find guidance? That was a nice point. So if you're asking should I go practice with this teacher? It's not let's talk about if the teacher's good or not. It's more like, would it be a good practice for you? Yeah. And in a one-on-one situation that you wouldn't say in a public forum.
Yes. Yeah. That's a good thing. I was just going to express my own kind of confusion and interest in this gray area because things like that, written into the tradition or say behind closed doors and in a gentle manner. And we had last week, we came up several times, when to say something, when it will do good, not even if it's necessarily true.
Oh, yeah.
It matters as long as it'll do good. And I start to think I didn't realize this stuff was written into the tradition. I thought they were style things, Thich Nhat Hanh sounds like they go more by these gentleness things. And I'm I've really been wrong. I didn't realize that these ways of being were not a matter of style, but they're actually written into the tradition.
What's written into the tradition?
These ways of communicating that are very gentle and passive, behind closed doors, in this way where you're not even directly addressing the person,
like
but
Dogen's.
Suggesting an overall idea about a behavior. But then you reminded me about Dogen. And I think about Bodhidharma. And I'm not inclined to think that it was... I think Dogen probably just broke his good ideas that he was writing at this time. So I'm just saying I'm kind of in this gray area.
Well, now we can also remember we have these three kind of views of each precept, right? The literal meaning, which we've been talking about. Then there's the compassionate meaning that usually is in accord with the literal, but we've been, you know, always bringing out examples of a compassionate accord with the precept that goes against the literal, just to show how that's possible. Mm-hmm. And Asanga does that. And with this one, Asanga says, and I think it's totally pertinent in this month in this country, right? The example he says is like, if there's a kind of an unjust government, you should actually try to divide people against each other. He's talking about that, causing division, from the right speech one. Speak of others' faults and cause division between people so that these people won't follow this corrupt leader. And you do this not out of any self, aggrandizement or self, promotion or anything for oneself, but just to benefit all beings. So I think, and I think that, political protest done in that spirit, of course, remembering our intention. It's not to just make people angry and cause a stir, which sometimes it can escalate into that, but actually to just, point out again the faults of a person rather than the evil person themselves, and make that point. And I think that Dogen, we could say he's breaking the precept, but we could say it's out of compassion, maybe, that he's speaking of these teachings to clarify the teachings in a very strong way, that if he wasn't so strong, maybe his audience would just not even notice he's saying it. Yes?
Someone actually asked me today, why do I wear my rapasu when I go to protest? Because I've been going to quite a few. And I said, it's because I actually go to a protest without having any enemy. I'm not feeling towards anyone. I'm just there to advocate for what I think is right. And maybe say, like I was holding the sign the other day saying, education, not deportation. So I'm saying not deportation. But I wasn't saying something against Donald Trump or anything. I was just emphasizing the subjects, you know, the actions.
Mm-hmm.
But it was interesting noticing that that's what came out when they asked me. I went, well, because I go there with no enemy.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
And I thought, that was like, oh, that is why.
Yeah, Rakasu.
Similar, that fits with this, it's not about criticizing someone, it's about trying to relieve suffering, so the emphasis on that.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And not for the self either, it's not, so I'm not going to get deported.
And
I totally agree, and I'm also though kind of pushing the edge of this and wondering, what about actually saying something against, but not mm-hmm. as in you're my enemy, but no, I disagree with that policy.
Mm-hmm.
And if, or that person, you know, like, I mean, like say some of the appointments that are being made, you know, I do really have a preference
mm-hmm.
and I do really feel like some really big things are at stake, but I don't have to demonize, I don't have to vilify, mm-hmm. but I could, you know, put my energy, whether it be money or voice or body, you know, to say yes to this and no to that,
mm-hmm.
and not break it. Because yep. I'm not saying something
yeah.
that's not true.
Yeah.
I'm just saying
yeah.
I disagree
yeah.
with your priority
yeah.
or with your approach.
Mm-hmm.
And what it's a shorthand if you say something like use the person's name, but really what you're protesting is their policies, not
yeah.
them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
yeah. So that's kind of the same. Even
yeah.
if you were to say no to Bannon mm-hmm. being appointed for something. Bannon isn't the person, it's not the point, it's, you know...
Alt-right radio,
alt-right.
Being a strategic advisor to the president of the United
yeah,
States.
Yeah, it's that.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and I think it's true that yeah, for sure we often use the person's name, and but that's I think a good practice thing is to remember when we do these things for short to not start believing that somehow the person's inherently evil or something. That really keep it clear it's the policy. And in a lot of the online petitions going around, there's some really strong language about the people, and sometimes not even saying. Sometimes kind of missing the policy and almost like, I want to hear more details about the policy, actually. Or it'd be nice if it was expressed more that way. And I know there's strong emotions about these things. So we have strong responses, but, bodhisattvas, we have to be careful. Yeah.
That's an interesting question because,
going with not speaking about others, and now this is outside of the sangha, so more contemporary, not speaking about anyone because unless you speak to them or just not speaking about them if they're not there, it certainly could, you know, get out and affect their reputation. That's not a good thing. But in this case, with Trump, Bannon, you know, other people, it's not about affecting their reputation. They're out there. They're so public. Behavior is for everyone to see. I mean, it's not like...
And we might even say we actually want to ruin their reputation in a way because they have so much power and so much self-promotion and high reputation based on false ideas, we might say, that we actually want to...
Even if we just say, so-and-so said such and such, so-and-so did such and such, which is public.
Like, isn't it in the Vinaya that a disciple of the Buddha does not grab her by the pussy? I mean,
when he says that, we don't have to say, you know, it's not like we're saying something that everybody doesn't already know.
Yeah.
That's sort of so interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I've actually been just recently I googled around like you know, list of Trump's racist and sexist statements, and I was thinking, oh, there'll be this list of hundreds and like extreme stuff, and I googled around a lot, and I was just surprised. Of course, there is some stuff, but there's a list of 10 things over 10 years, and I was like, wow. I'm surprised how little that nobody has actually done that. Wouldn't that be the most obvious thing to compile the list?
Again,
there, there was one though.
Well, I found at least few.
Somebody was doing it like for the New York Times or something.
New York Times did a 2-page spread. In fact, there was hundreds upon hundreds. Things he'd said that were damning and inaccurate. Hillary Clinton was like, but it went through for Black Lives Matter.
That'd be interesting. If anyone finds it, send me a link or something. Yeah.
So is that different then? I mean, if it's so much in the public view, I mean, he's making himself be this public person.
Yeah, and also doesn't apologize or anything.
So if you just repeat what he said, is that talking of someone's fault?
No, I think if it comes from this compassionate thing of we want this to be exposed because we don't want him to continue to harm others like this, then I think it may be literally, according to some meaning, speaking of others' faults. But again, the compassionate level is the bodhisattva vows to break the literal out of compassion. I think that's why this compassionate aspect is brought up. Yes?
Back to Kathy's comment, I feel like it's this fundamental question, like, and there's a lot of push and pull about it, like, the fundamental question is, on one hand, we include everything, which is the ultimate meaning, and on the other hand, don't we hate? And that's the conventional, so I feel like we're trying to decide, and there's like lots of conflicting views, like, so now we're in this situation, which one do we do?
I don't know if they have to be contradictory, and I don't know if I would put it exactly like that we hate more, maybe we could say that, but more like, let's try to point out the ultimate, so this is a good segue into Dogen's version of his commentary on this precept, which is generally comes from the ultimate point of view. Says, within Buddha Dharma, all are in the same way the same dharma, the same realization, the same practice. So remember he's talking about the Bodhisattva Sangha, right? We could say, really, is Trump into the same realization and same practice as us? But I think from this ultimate perspective, we might be able to say, yeah, it's Buddha nature we share with him and all beings. And I would say maybe another way would, from this ultimate point of view is each precept would be not believing in a dualistic belief. So like, you know, birth and death for the first one, ownership for the second one. And so I think this would be like not believing in the reality, the true reality of mistakes or faults, and in the duality of self and other. So if we realize this ultimate meaning of the precepts, of where we really we are like this one bright pearl, right? Then, if we could truly realize that, then we are not going to speak of others' faults in a self-centered way, and how do we help prevent others from harming others? I think there's maybe ways to do this that aren't like exactly hating hate, but are not passively allowing it, but speaking out in a new kind of way.
I had a story. I was on a trail crew, and we would all wash dishes together as a crew. And one girl talked a lot, and a lot of people found it irritating. And so this girl started talking while we were washing dishes, and this other girl was like, pardon my language, but she was like, shut the fuck up, bitch. And I was like, whoa, take it easy. And she's like, I'll kick your ass too, bitch. And I was like, whoa, like, go ahead and kick my ass, but it won't make you any less of an asshole. And it was like bit in the butt like that. Like, and so to put that in like Buddhist language is like, it won't make what you're doing any less like harmful.
Mm.
Like if you kicked my ass for like interfering, I don't know. Mm. It just felt kind of like,
yeah.
I was just like, whoa, like that's not all right.
Yeah, like, not backing down.
It wasn't attacking her, but then she came at me with a.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe I just really like this story. My bad.
Yeah, it can be. I think maybe the point is that we can have a strong response, and also that was kind of playful, and I think playful is often the most effective response. If we get really too overly serious, then we really conflict is unworkable. But a little bit of playfulness, even in a extremely harmful situation, can be really helpful. Did you have a question?
Well,
she's already had a quota.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know how that story kind of fits in, but just like what you were saying, like I have, that's what I heard from Red last week, like this inclusiveness and hating is a very strong statement. So yeah, that I just really do feel like there, and the San Francisco Zen Center abbots wrote a statement about this situation now that I didn't read, but I think found it that was very inclusive. But you can't ignore, like, people were asking Red and other people wrote responses to this statement that I didn't read those either, but judging by the headlines, they were.
So you have to be careful speaking of others' faults.
We've had this discussion right here today, like, it's this inclusiveness, but then a minute later, we're like, wait a second.
Inclusive of who?
of everybody.
Everybody.
Yeah.
And what does inclusive mean to you?
Okay. Well, this is my little thing. I preach it constantly, so excuse me for preaching it again, and that's fine if you don't agree, but to me, the absolute does not mean that we don't function in the relative. And in the case of our political discourse, the relative reality means that we are making distinctions. And inclusive to me means that I see the humanity of everybody, including Donald Trump, including all those people. And you know, just understanding and knowing that if I sat down and talked with them in a non-confrontational environment where we were just being people together, you know, I trust that they're human and that they're not, you know, that they're not devils. But that doesn't, and so I'm including that I'm not suffering. But that doesn't mean I'm not actively working to oppose their policies, and that I'm not giving money to the people who are opposing their policies. I can't imagine, and I would disagree, if the teaching of inclusivity somehow means that because we know that we're all one, we therefore, what? We're passive and we just let, because they're making choices. So if we're not also participating in making choices, mm-hmm. then I think we're not being good citizens. Because we live in a world where the choices will strongly impact the lives of people and the fate of the planet and our children and our grandchildren. I just can't imagine that Buddhist inclusivity would mean that we wouldn't, at the same time, take righteous action.
Well, because it also includes our feelings and actions for justice and all. That's part of inclusivity.
And I didn't read these things either, but what you said is, well, what do we mean by inclusivity?
Yeah, you know? It doesn't mean like we just accept harm.
Because some people would imply that.
They might. Yeah, they
some
might.
Buddhist types. Uh-huh.
Some nihilist types.
I'd say it's the opposite. It's the everything's great and groovy and everything's fine and it's all beautiful.
There's a type there. There's a where you get stuck in the ultimate.
Oh yes, you get stuck in the ultimate, right?
Like Zen sickness.
Emptiness, sickness.
Ultimately, we don't know what it all means. Yeah.
Too much
emptiness.
So whatever.
It could be like that.
Because mm-hmm. we're all one, and we're all you know whatever.
And who are we to know how it's all going to work out?
Yeah, and it's all for the good anyhow. Because God is good. It's called New Age. It's called Santa Cruz Crystal Mind.
This is reminding me of my
your buttons being pressed.
This reminded me of my train hopper friend because he thinks our society is sick and that it's really harming the earth and it's not a healthy way to live, including shipping food, including riding in cars. And if you're going to live within this society, I think most of us drive cars and most of us eat shipped food that was picked by someone else. We probably all eat bananas here. We don't have bananas on in North America. You're like, where are those coming from? And like, is that... The way I view him, though, is like... He definitely struggles with these two, 6 and 7, because there's a certain righteousness. You know, he's on this righteous path, and part of me believes he is, because there's this real awareness and intention. And then his other side, though, is that he's really sweet and he wants to take care of things. Mm-hmm. And I feel like as long as you stick to those, you take this vow, then you'll ultimately be guided into, hopefully, like, re-entering society instead of like being like, I'm just not even going to participate with that at all, you know?
Yeah.
You can understand the urge to not want to. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's like, it is sick in my mind. Yeah, mm-hmm. I agree with him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think there might be multiple ways to uphold these precepts that look contradictory. Like some people seem to be able to get away with speaking really vehemently and strongly, like I think of someone like Elizabeth Warren. Mm-hmm. She can just say it, and it seems fine when she says it to me. There's a style about her that she can do it. But I don't think I would do so well with that. I think I would sound too critical. It's just that wouldn't work for me. So, like, maybe for your friend, he can be righteous, but I think if I was righteous, it would come out bad. It wouldn't work right. So, you know, some people I think can, well, like Dogen, speaking really, you know, harshly, he can maybe get away with it. Maybe it's like one of those tricky karma things. I was thinking of... I was thinking, like, sometimes teachers who have done transgression by, you know, having affairs with students, sometimes people speak, you know, quite negatively about them and hold them accountable, and they seem to be able to do that very skillfully. And other people will be able to say, here's my teacher, and I will not say anything ill about him. He's an amazing person, amazing teacher, and they seem to be able to do that really successfully. Mm. So maybe we just have to work out how do we uphold these precepts ourselves, fit with our personality and our intention. And some of us can do the kind of something more direct, and some of us have to be more kind of around the corner.
Yeah, so Tenshin Roshi, I think of as someone who's actually usually quite careful about speech and about these things. He's taught me so much just from his own attention to it, but sometime in the last year, there was one of these Zen scandal things, and it was in a meeting of other senior priests, and they were saying, people were saying, yeah, I can't believe this teacher, da 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 da. And they kind of like, after a while, he's being kind of quiet, and they turn to him and, well, what do you say, Reb? And he's like, actually, my practice is not advanced enough to comment on this at this time. And I thought, wow. I thought that was a great teaching for those who, it was getting pretty loose, the speech here. It was getting beyond actions. It was getting, too much into the person, I think. And so maybe he said that in that situation, and if everyone else was being quiet, maybe he would have said something, but it's like enough's been said, you know.
So you said in the beginning that this is difficult for you.
Yeah.
Not speaking about others. What is difficult?
I just find like complaining mind. Mm-hmm. Like you know, and Shoho is kind of like my confidant, right? It's like, she's like, because I can't really like do it in the Sangha at large, but I can complain about the Sangha to her. Yeah, I know.
We're all going to get Shoho drunk.
Ask what I've been saying. Yeah. Yeah, so like, you know, it's usually coming from my own pain, right? That's what I think. Oh, I think usually it's not just, hey, let's be like, you know, get all into like people's faults. It's more like, wow, I'm like hurting here. Mm-hmm. And then the way I'm not talking about it so skillfully, mm-hmm. I do at least say, well, let's just keep this between us. And she can do it with me too. We'll both point out to each other, I'm sorry, I shouldn't really be talking this way. And like, yeah, so am I, but we're doing it anyway.
You know, Patrick, you said to me probably 9 years ago, we were talking about this precept. Catherine Stark did a class. It was probably one of the first classes I took here. And we were talking about it, and you said, I just don't talk about other people. Period. And I don't know if it's true. You don't remember.
Was that slander?
It was important to me, and I practice it. And if I had to do that, I would preface it with, "I'm just going. I just need to vent here. I don't need to do this. But I really need to vent right now."
Well, I will say one story that I do tell. Over and over again is about at work when we would have, you know, meetings, and maybe this is where it came up, because I tell it all the time, is that I really realized that all of us were kind of getting off on you know, we were the, it was in the jail, when I worked in the jail, we love talking about, you know, how the Twin Lakes program really was messing up, or the crisis house was really messing up, and when we originally did a precepts class with Catherine, or maybe the right speech class. I said to myself, I'm just going to stop this. Mm-hmm. And actually, after a while, my coworkers would tease me about, you know, I never said anything bad about anybody. But it was just in this one, I took this one practice on. I mean, it's like when you do a mindfulness practice, you don't say you're going to be mindful about every bite. You just say, I'm going to be mindful for the first 10 minutes of breakfast. Mm-hmm. So I did take on that practice, and it was very successful. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really kind of calmed down the whole group, and our meetings went a lot faster. So I do brag about that, but it was because I agree that it's very hard not to talk about, you know, other people, especially if you think you've been harmed and you. Mm-hmm. You do have a confidant that you say, I've just got a, what's it called?
Vent.
Vent. Thank you for letting me vent.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Vent is an exception. No, I think it's a wonderful practice. I really do. And around the same time, there was that movie with Seymour Hersh, Truth or something. He was a priest. And nobody saw this. Oh, it was so wonderful. Because there's an image here about, you know, somebody is harming his reputation.
Oh, yeah. So. Doubt.
Mm-hmm. It lets the feathers go out. It's an image. It's like a dream. The feathers from the pillow are released into the wind over a mountaintop. And, of course, you can't take those feathers back. You can't take that speech back. Mm-hmm. Once you've said something, you can never take it back. And it was around that same time I remember seeing it. It was just so, it really, it's a great practice not to talk. Why talk about people?
Part of the root of it is like an unwillingness to feel the pain, like the, you like find fault and then you like, but you're unwilling to feel the pain of actually experiencing that fault.
We want to blame.
Yeah, it's like not mine or somehow it's like it deflects the pain.
Exactly. I think that's it.
Because I'm thinking of my friend, and I sent him this. There's this like Tibetan lama who gets pulled into civilization for the first time ever. And he's on the skyscraper looking out over Hong Kong, and he's like amazed, and then he starts crying, and he has to be carried away by his attendants because he's just overwhelmed with grief looking out at this vast city. Just like all these people being born and dying, and he's just like, oh, without a shred of dharma to help them, you know, he's like devastated. And like something about that, like living in this world is so painful. It's like way easier to just be like, that's not me. I'm not a part of this pain.
Well, let's go into the next precept, which is very similar. Okay. Not praising self and belittling others. You could translate it as belittling others, criticizing others, disparaging others, blaming others. So it has this two-part thing. This is self and others. Praise self, you know, elevate self, de-elevate other. Which also seems like defensiveness is a big part of this one. And maybe if a bodhisattva was practicing this precept, maybe they would not be able to be a politician. I mean, these politicians, it's so much about like promoting oneself and often belittling others. Maybe it doesn't have to be. But in these debates, wow. We often, I think it comes, this kind of arrogance, so praising self is a kind of arrogance that often comes from doubting oneself. That arrogance comes from self-doubt, which doesn't seem like it because it's like this, it seems like it's inflating oneself, but it's like the need to do that seems to come from feeling actually like not so sure. I think if we're really confident in ourselves, we don't need to praise ourselves so much. And this is the classic Lotus Sutra story, right? The Bodhisattva never praising self and disparaging others. Y'all know this story? I'll just read one paragraph of it, because and there's a song too by Greg Fain. So, at that time there was a bodhisattva monk named Never Disrespectful, or Never Disparaging. Why do you think he was named this? That monk bowed before everyone he met, whether monk, nun, layman, laywoman, and praised them, saying, "I deeply respect you. I would never dare to be disrespectful or arrogant toward you." Why? Because all of you are practicing the bodhisattva way and will surely become Buddhas. He didn't devote himself to reading and reciting sutras, just went around bowing to people. And if he saw people in the distance, he'd go up to them and he'd bow and say, "I would never dare disrespect you because you'll all become Buddhas." And amongst these people, there were those who became angry, enraged, and mean-spirited, and reviled and cursed him, saying, "This ignorant monk who takes it on himself to announce that he does not disrespect us and assures us of becoming Buddhas, where did he come from? We have no use for such empty false assurances." But even when cursed and angry, people came, said this to him, he always said, "You'll become Buddhas. I never disparage you." Oh, that's such a great story about this precept. A radical version of this precept. And then Zen, we have that story of Dilshan carrying his bowls, this koan of the old venerable teacher Dilshan walks into the dining hall with his eating bowls, and the Tenzo, Shui Feng, says, "Hey, old man, what are you doing here that we haven't rung the umpan and sounded the drum for the meal? It's not ready yet," even though it was actually late. So instead of just apologizing for the meal being late, he kind of praised, sort of arrogantly praised himself, this Tenzo, and disparaged the old teacher. And the venerable old teacher could have said, "This young whippersnapper student needs some training here to talk that way. And how dare you talk that way to me?" And instead, he just silently turned around and left with his bowls. Came back later when the bell rang. And the story goes on from there, but that's the kind of the heart of it, actually, I think. And might say, well, that's a kind of uneventful Zen story. But I think you could say it's about this precept. It's about this likely scenario to praise oneself and disparage this uppity Tenzo, but just not doing anything, not being defensive, actually was a great teaching, and we might hope that Shui Feng kind of got the message, which he might not have if the teacher had said, "You shouldn't talk that way, and by the way, the meal's late." Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the Diamond Sangha, the translation is not praising oneself at the expense of others.
At the expense of others.
At the expense. Because one thing, I think sometimes we can praise ourselves and it's not at the expense of anyone, it's just a celebration because we're all just one big family. And look at me, I can do this thing. Which isn't to say that you can't do this thing too, we can all do this thing. You know, so I like when it's linked with at the expense of others. Because I think there's a place for praising ourselves.
Yeah, maybe if it can be in a light-hearted way that's not arrogant.
That's also the comparing.
Comparison. Comparison is a big part.
Yeah, comparing mind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I could see that if we're really taking it light-hearted. But this is a commentary from Tenshin Roshi about even just praising self in maybe a kind of arrogant way, where he says, in the realm of Dharma, ignoring the dependent co-arising of self is the equivalent of original sin. It is the fundamental human disaster Not seeing how all beings kindly support and sustain our virtue and goodness, it is possible to speak of our own virtue as something separate from others. In such a state of ignorance, you may speak of your virtue as appearing almost in spite of others. You forget that it is really only due to the support of countless others that you accomplish anything of merit. That's a strong statement, but I think Brother David Steinerast also says something like this, that if something good has happened through you, then you can just be more, instead of being proud, you can be grateful. That's always his thing, is gratitude. You can be grateful that everything supported you to manifest this good activity.
Self-praise is like taking credit.
Credit, yeah, I think it's all. Yeah, yeah, like I did it myself. Yeah. Yeah, so he's ignoring the dependent co-arising of the self is original sin. Yeah. And the ultimate meaning of this, according to Dogen's commentary on this precept, is manifesting the Dharma body. On earth, there is not an inch of ground. So I think this is like, the Dharma body is all-inclusive. It includes everything. So there's there's no space outside the Dharma body. There's not an inch of separate ground. Everything is the Dharma body. So therefore, there's no self and others. And this, when we realize no self and others, then it doesn't make any sense to praise this limited part of the Dharma body and disparage that other part of the Dharma body. Commenting on Dogen's comment, Bonjin Dotan says, quoting this old Chinese ancestor, the entire world in the 10 directions is the true human body. So, same thing as the all-inclusive Dharma body. So these two precepts, I think, very similar. Oh, the actual precept says in the Brahmajala Sutra, not praising self and belittling others. A disciple of Buddha does not praise self and belittle others or encourage others to do so. One must not create the causes, conditions, methods, or karma of praising self and disparaging others. A bodhisattva ought to be willing to stand in for all sentient beings and endure humiliation and slander, accepting blame and letting others have all the praise. If instead one displays one's own virtues and conceals the good points of others, thus causing them to suffer slander, one commits a parajika offense. So it's even going further and saying, not only not praising self and belittling others, but reversing it, being willing to be falsely accused and accepting the slander and letting others have the praise, even if it's not justified, maybe. It kind of sounds like if it's not willing to stand in for sentient beings, it sounds like even if it's mixed up, we don't get defensive.
I think that happens in Zendo here, where somebody does something wrong in terms of the form, and then someone else might think that you did it because you're in that role, and just to be able to go like, oh, okay, no problem. And you don't say, oh, it wasn't me. I wasn't the one. I think it's nice when that happens. You can just to be able to just go, not have to say that bit, not have to defend.
Yeah.
Just go, oh, sure, yeah, no, I'll close those windows. Well, you did close them. Someone else it doesn't matter. You have to say that.
Yeah, that's a nice point. It's nice when that happens. Yeah, because that's a good case how often, and maybe we might even say usually, it really doesn't matter. Like, you know, if it's over and over and now we have the reputation of the window ignorer, then we might, oh, well, actually. And then I think of the extreme case is this famous Zen story of Hakuin gets accused of fathering this baby, right? And here, you know, this is, take your baby and raise him yourself, you lousy monk. And, oh, is that so? Like, wow, talk about, like, taking on the blame of somebody else who's hiding something and put it on him. and not defending, it's hard to imagine.
Yeah, that is hard to imagine.
It's hard to imagine.
I'm almost like, is that, because, yeah, everybody whips out that story when it's
Yeah, and then right, then he gets praised when they find out that it really wasn't him. I can't believe you didn't defend yourself and you raised this kid. Oh, is that so? So maybe it didn't really happen, right?
Well, yeah, even if like, if one time in your own life when there's actually what feels like real stakes, like something that is important to you, I don't know.
Yeah, so maybe if it really does matter and it's, we're not, maybe it doesn't have to be defensiveness if we're actually, if there's some benefit behind expressing a point. I think that's where it maybe could be so, right? We want the truth to be revealed, we want the point to be expressed, and how to do that in a way that doesn't get into like a kind of contracted form of self-defensiveness. I think that's a tricky practice, but a great one to try.
I love the openness of this. Like, oh, I'm going to have a baby now. Yeah. I haven't been planning that. Right?
Yeah, totally open. Yeah, it's hard to...
I kind of get the message, but there's also, like, people have circumstances when they're being persecuted, if they say that's so, and then they just live the rest of their life in the prison. You know,
it's like Jesus.
They have to kind of...
Yeah, like Jesus.
Jesus got credit for it.
Whole religion.
Yeah.
But you gotta meet.
Yeah, there's these extreme cases, yeah. And we might say.
I'm wrong for being Jewish, and I should die for that. No, I don't think so.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah, and can it be for the benefit of all beings? And so Jesus is interesting, and then we say, well, he got credit for it, and then but a bodhisattva wouldn't even necessarily want some personal credit for giving up themselves. Not saying that, you know, we could or should do this, but I think these extreme examples like Hakuin, I like the stories just because I'm so far from that myself. It's a good reminder of what might be possible. Well, it's just about time to stop. And I did want to bring up the whole NVC thing, which we don't really have time for, but, you know, nonviolent communication. Oh, it's a great book, huh? Do you know about this? Maybe everybody knows NVC already. But I think it's a way to practice with right speech, the principles. And it's a little bit like Neti said, the point of about not the person but the action. When you did that at that time, I felt such and such because I need to feel safe, and so will you please do such and such, is the format, the four-part format. And I think it's a beautiful way. It can get, I know people sometimes think it gets clunky if you try to follow it like a formula, but the principle behind it, which is basically just kind of like removing this kind of self and other duality, I think there's a real spiritual heart of it, is beautiful. We dedicate the merit of our study of the Bodhisattva precepts to all beings everywhere. May they open to the miraculous light of these precepts. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.